Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here on the program this morning Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the U of I, and occasionally is here to do this show that we have been now doing for a very long time on money management and investing. Most of the time, it's David Sinnoh who's here doing the show. And when Dave can't be here, Kevin is our backup guy, and he's been good enough to be here a number of times, particularly, I guess, it has happened in the summertime. When Dave's wanted to go fishing or something.
I think that's the usual reason.
Good morning.
Good morning, David.
And we appreciate it. And it's the same kind of thing. You know, I'm sure he might have a few thoughts on financial investment matters to share. But the important thing is that it can be a resource for you. You have some particular question having to do with your own finances. Well, give us a call and give us the basics, and I know he will give you some the benefit of his advice. And I'd say the same thing that I would say when Dave's here. You know, don't just do something because Kevin says to do it. Do as much research as you can. Do all your homework, but this can be one piece that you can add in there as you're trying to figure out, you know, what the best thing is for your particular situation. So, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, it's good to have you here.
Thank you, Dave. It's always nice to fill in not only for Dave Sinnoh, but to see some of the old friends here at Will.
Yeah. Kevin, we do have a relationship with him that goes back a long, long time, back to the day, back in the day when he was working in various local financial institutions, and he was one of those guys that, you know, periodically you hear these people on the telephone that are giving you the telling you what the market is doing at that point, the market reports, and he was doing that going back a long, long time.
We could say the 1970s, but we wouldn't want to date ourselves, would we?
All right. No, we wouldn't want to. Okay, so again, questions are certainly welcome. What you have any general thoughts about what's happening with the market these days?
Well, general thoughts. Let's begin with the NPR piece we just heard. This morning's report on consumer prices follows yesterday's producer price report. The oddity, perhaps, that struck me was the announcement in the NPR report that this morning's inflation measure was, quote, much higher than has been running, unquote, or something to that effect. At the same time, of course, 5 seconds, 10 seconds later, the Dow is up 100-plus points again. Most people would hear that and say, well, gee, if inflation is worse or rising, why is the stock market happy and going higher? And I think that's one of the interesting things about investment. We always need to kind of separate what day-to-day noise is constantly bombarding us from what long-term and prudent actions are based or should be based on. So I think if there's a theme to begin the talk today, we could just take it right out of the NPR headline announcement on CPI and go from that. It's very seldom a case where a piece of news in a given day sets the tone that is anything other than very short-term or just noise.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just looking at a story here about this thing that you're just talking about, and it looks as if there is one component here that's been more influential than anything else in this bump up in the inflation rate, and that is the price of gasoline, which nobody likes, but I guess everybody just, they grit their teeth, and you've got to fill the car, so you pay what it is that they ask. That makes it sound like you can have a big overall statistic like rate of inflation, but then you have to look more closely and say, okay, well really what's going on here, and it's not something that cuts across the entire economy, but it's maybe just one particular thing.
One particular thing in an index report like these monthly series. But, of course, people look and should be looking beyond the headlines. The cost of energy, whether it's gasoline, diesel, oil, electricity, whatever, the cost of energy does factor into the production and transportation of much of what we do in our economy. So even though we are a very service-oriented economy, as opposed to productions of goods, the cost of energy is certainly one of the more, ingrained components in producing what our economy does to consume domestically as well as export. So it's like everything else. There are so many facets to it. we need to look at a little bit more than just the headline impact. Even if I didn't take any action, even if I didn't own a car, the cost of energy will eventually factor into what I have to do, and that includes things like eat and have a roof over my head.
Yeah. Well, let me give the phone numbers here. I don't think I did that right at the beginning. Certainly questions are welcome. You want to talk with Kevin, 333-9455, Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and so the call's on us, 800-222-9455. One of the things that that I know that you talked about, and Dave certainly has over the years, and many, many people who work in financial planning, they always say, the mantra is, you got to be in for the long haul. And that the recommendation is that as part of your investment strategy, you ought to have money in the stock market. And that probably the best way to do that is not to try to buy individual stocks, but to buy some kind of a mutual fund to spread out your risk. At the same time, I guess, I'm sure that people, you know, they look at the performance of the market. It does go up. It does go down. The overall trend seems to be up. And I'm sure that there are people who look at that and think, well, really, how can it just, is it just going to keep going up forever?
Again, an excellent question. When I came in this morning and was talking with some old friends out in the hallway, the question of cost of farm ground, the value of farm ground's gone up so much over the past 5 years. Should I be buying farm ground right now? And my answer to that is, well, as an investment, no. You know, unfortunately, the value going up also means effectively the price has gone up. If I have a rule I like to follow, it's buy low and sell high. This is not a time where I would think to be buying farm ground for an investment. It's been a wonderful occurrence for those that own farm ground as an investment or as a speculation. But I would venture to guess that you ask the average person who has had that same piece of ground in the family for over 100 years, when they look at it, aside from feeling wealthier just as a number on a piece of paper when it comes to putting their personal balance sheet together, or on the bad side of things, feeling poorer when the property tax bill arrives, they don't really look at the value of farm ground as an investment at all. It's one of the basic inputs to their endeavor. It's one of the necessary raw ingredients. So investments are things, you know, that I would love to, you know, put into a category of saying these are things outside of the necessary inputs for my welfare. Necessary inputs for my welfare are things like the house I live in. I've never considered my own house an investment. And I always thought that people who did may have been focusing too much on what might be an illiquid asset. Again, back to the notion of a farmer here in central Illinois, unless the person were winding down his operation and had no desire to continue or have any income from the continued ownership of the asset, you liquidate the asset. If that's your gain, you've just liquidated your livelihood. The same goes for your house. You'll always need a place to live. Why would you consider the place you live an investment from a perspective of saying, well, I'll sell it one day and cash out? Maybe your heirs will, but you'll still need a place to live. So to me, investments focus more on things that revolve around a central core of what you do in your life. You've got to have a place to live, and you've got to have a means to produce an income. Given those things as, you know, the core, investments then become things like stocks, like bonds, like other real assets that may be considered tangent to the core value things that we all have to exist.
We have a caller, or had a caller, who had a question that it's fairly general, but I'm sure that you can say some things, who are just interested in having you talk a little bit about CDs, certificates of deposit, and what you think about them, and perhaps also the question would be, well, how does that fit into a larger sort of a picture about what you do with your money?
Yeah, CDs, certificates of deposits at financial institutions, insured deposits, very, what I would say, bedrock to the foundation of a component of a person's wealth that I'll put in a category called savings. Again, savings, I would differentiate from investments. the value of the CD will never go down. So the dollar you put there is always that dollar plus the accumulated interest. An investment is a variable value asset. We expect that the rate of return on an investment is going to be comprised of two components. One is income, if the asset produces income, and the other is a capital change or capital gain. It appreciates in value. Those are the kind of things that fit an investment category. CDs are savings categories, and again, in a stepwise function, these are the things that people need to really begin with. You put safe money into CDs. You put money in there that is the way to get a little bit higher rate of return over something like a passbook savings account. But again, it's safe money in that you have a known need for it in the future, or it's the emergency fund money that, heaven forbid, something ugly happens, you just need money now. You can get into the CD. You might have to pay an interest penalty if you break it, but it's modest given the need for the money. Mm-hmm. An investment is the last thing you want to have to sell when there's an emergency or when you least can afford to sell it. And again, that gets to the variable value notion of it. If you're lucky enough to buy into a stock index fund at the time when it's 2001, 2002, after a large pullback in the stock market. And of course, now we look back 4 or 5 years later and say, gee, didn't that work just wonderfully? Remember that the reverse could be true. If that money were safe haven money and you'd bought into it at a time in 1999 and needed to sell it in 2002, taking 40 cents of your dollar and just watching it evaporate would not be fun.
Yeah. So, and I guess the one basic thing you always got to keep in mind about certificate of deposit is that the longer you're willing to tie the money up, the better interest rate they will give you.
Generally speaking, that's true.
The downside, though, is that means that you could go into your bank and say, okay, I have here $10,000 and I want to put this into a 2-year certificate deposit. And let's say, that's swell. Here's what we'll pay you. And we'll see you in 2 years. But then you could be sitting there with your 2-year CD, and 6 months down the road, the interest rate could go up, but you're still going to get the other mm-hmm. rate because you signed saying, I'll give you the money for 2 years. So probably for that reason, I know also the thing that old Dave would say is don't go out more than, well, I don't know what he might say, a year maybe. Don't lock it up for 2 years or longer, because the chances are that you could do better if you're just willing to hold a little shorter.
Well, and the other approach, too, is we don't have to look at the opportunity to have just one certificate of deposit. The bank doesn't limit you. If you used the amount that you used in your example, a $10,000 deposit, there's nothing wrong with breaking it into four pieces of $2,500 each. That way you have the ability to put together what we'd call a ladder of maturities. Just for a very simple example, maybe a quarter of it goes into a 6-month, 12-month, 18- and 24-month. What that does basically is not in a sense of giving you access to the money sooner from a point of view of need, but basically it allows you to roll the interest rate every 6 months. If you think of it literally as a ladder that every time you take a step, you're moving a rung higher, in 6 months, which we all know passes much too fast, you take that money and you go out and you buy a new 24-month CD with it, you're starting back where you were. You have a quarter of your money coming due every 6 months. And what you'll see after three iterations, as long as the yield curve is upward sloping, is you'll be earning a 24-month rate on all of your money, even though you still have a quarter of it coming due every 6 months. So a ladder of maturities makes sense for a lot of savers. It's a very powerful yet very simple tool.
Yeah, very good. All right. We have a caller here in Champaign to talk with. Let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about a young UVI graduate and establishing credit. Managed to get through school without any credit card debt, but now is looking at, getting a credit card so he can start establishing credit. And the bank where he had his debit card said, oh, sure, we'll give you one if your parents will co-sign. Should that be necessary for a young person? And do you know of any websites or resources that we could investigate a little bit?
How long has it been since graduation? Just May?
Just May.
It's... Well, golly, I hate to hear myself say what I'm about to say, but let me go ahead and do it. It's only the 15th of June, and what I'll predict is in the coming 90 days, this fresh graduate's mailbox will be stuffed with credit card applications.
Well, we've received a few already.
Well, the barrage is only yet to begin. Back to your first mention, if the bank you're used to dealing with would issue a credit card to your son or daughter, and we'll assume that there's no problem at all with a credit history, the problem might only be just no history.
I think that's it.
Then a co-signature is not unusual, but again, I would say it's not very common anymore either. It probably represents a very cautious approach that the bank has made if they've made that offer. And quite honestly, I'm not joking that over the next 90 days, once the database is populated with your child's stature as a fresh college graduate, the mailbox is going to be cluttered with all sorts of credit card applications. So what I would do is wait. There's no real reason for parents to co-sign at this point in the graduate's life. I would also give even a stronger word of caution because, again, that mailbox is going to be tempting them with all sorts of wonderful things, earn points for travel, cash back awards, earn points to buy a new car, no annual fees, on and on and on and on. It's a really competitive business. And their opportunity to have a credit card is going to be the good news. Their opportunity to have multiple credit cards is going to be the bad news. So the parents need to have a little discussion about, you will be getting a credit card. It's only a matter of literally days.
Mm-hmm.
So put it under 100, call it 90 days, and say, you will be getting, and let us help you choose which credit card offer appears to be the best for your circumstances, and then let's limit it to that one.
Okay. It should be limited to one, and go ahead and choose among the offers that he receives.
Yes.
On the little box on the back that should tell you all the pertinent details.
It'll give you a majority of the things to look for. The consumer credit laws are pretty straightforward in terms of what must be disclosed. A couple of things that you should look for in any credit card application is whether or not it's a fixed or variable rate of interest. And I only throw that out there first, not because it's the most important thing, but it's the thing that's easiest to focus on. My hopes would be that the credit card would always be paid at the end of the month and there would never be an interest charge. But that's a goal. It doesn't mean that it might always work. So in the event there's ever a balance on it that is being charged interest, look at it and see if it's a fixed or a variable rate. If it is a variable rate, I will almost guarantee you that there'll be some teaser introductory, very low, below market rate of interest. I'm very hesitant to see any value in that because interest rates vary and that's an unknown, and unknowns provide an opportunity for risk. So I would favor a fixed rate of interest. Now it's a matter of saying which one is the lowest. The other thing to look at that will be in the Fed box will be the grace period. Some credit cards, especially to first-time users or first-issue credit cards, will have a very short or even no grace period. That means the moment you make a charge, you're paying interest.
Mm.
It's customary for the garden variety credit cards that you or I or most adults carry to have a 25-day grace period. So again, making a charge today, paying the entire balance when the bill is sent before the due date means that you'll never pay interest on it. So look for the fixed or variable. Hopefully it's a fixed, obviously the lowest fixed rate among the offers, and then secondly, the grace period. Hopefully it's got a 25-day grace period and you're not in the interest clock.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. This is a show we've been doing for a long time every month to talk about money management. Dave Sinnoh usually here. He's taken the month off, and Kevin said he would be good enough to come in here and substitute. Same kind of thing, though. If you have questions about financial planning, your strategies, investing, money management, any and all of that, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. We're almost at our midpoint here. One of the things that I've noticed around my neighborhood is there seem to be an awful lot of houses that are for sale suddenly. And now, that may just be that this is the time of year when people do think about that. And I guess if you live in an academic community, if people are moving, maybe they're also thinking about that. So it's a great time to be a buyer. And it has been for some time now, actually. It's a good time to be a buyer, not such a great time to be a seller. And I found myself wondering, well, if you had to sell your house, well, you have to. But if it was a matter of choice, would you say, well, I'm going to wait for a little while? Or might you say, I'm afraid things are going to get even worse. Mm-hmm. The market's going to fall even further. The value of my house is going to decline. So maybe I'm going to say, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it now in the hopes that then I'll get the best price that I can.
Yeah, again, if we're thinking about selling a house, I'm going to start with a very simple approach. Again, you know my bias. The place I live is basically the roof over my head. I didn't buy it with an anticipation of selling it at a higher price. So the advice I'm going to give in that circumstance is obviously going to be totally different from advice to a person who bought it with the expressed thinking that I'm going to sell it for more and move up. So bottom line is, if it's a roof over my head, period, and I'm relocating, even if it's within town to a different neighborhood, put the sign in the yard and do it, because the value aspect of it shouldn't be the driver of the decision. If it's a speculative process that you ended up in the house, whether it's a rental or your own occupied, then you have to look very carefully at your cost to carry and what price you basically are in the thing at. And when I mean cost to carry, I mean so many people that got into houses in the past 5 years and did it in a way of thinking that, well, this is a move-up house. In 4 or 5 years, I'm going to sell it, make a home run, and move into another, bigger, newer house, so on and so forth. If they unfortunately set up some of the more creative loans that were very prevalent over the past 4 or 5 years, they've got to look at interest reset rates. They've got to look at amortization table changes. They've got to look at the terms of it that all boil down to how much is this thing going to cost me every month. And sometimes, you know, you might have a goal set at, gee, I'm going to hit a home run, and you might have to settle for a single, but it's sure better than walking back to the dugout after you strike out. Mm. So, you know, it's everybody's got their own pain point there. The housing market was in a very, very unsustainable tear. Even in a town like Champaign-Urbana, I think it was obvious. When you read the national statistics and see what was going on and why, you know, it didn't take a lot of head scratching to figure out that this could not continue forever. Too many people were buying too big of houses in too many places. And it was just, it's like any other trend. When it gets way out of the sustainable long-term, what can it do type of relationship, you know, that's a signal. Things have gotten too extreme. So I think we're seeing a little undoing of that extreme.
Mm-hmm. We have several callers here. Let's take them in the order they came in. First is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about student loans. As an undergrad, I wasn't in a position to get subsidized student loans, so I have about $20,000 that I consolidated. But now as a graduate student, I'm in the position to get some subsidized loans. And I was wondering if you thought it was a good idea to pay the unsubsidized loans with the subsidized loans, if that was a good strategy.
Generally speaking, I would say yes. That's not a very uncommon circumstance. and a little like saying, can I borrow money at 6% to pay off an 8% debt outstanding? The answer is always yes. Just be a little bit careful in the comparison. And perhaps the loan people at the student assistance can go through your existing debt contract and literally look for the pros and cons. But on the surface of things, I'd say yes, it's an action you should take.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Moultrie County is next. This is a caller on line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
How come if you cancel a credit card, it affects your credit rating?
How do you mean affect?
Well, it's my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought my understanding was that if you cancel a credit card, even if you're not using it, that it can impact your credit rating in a bad way.
I've never seen that happen. In the credit bureau scores, the drivers there go for things such as late pays, slow pays, or no pays.
Okay.
So, you know, if a credit card is has been issued, and let's say it's like many of us, we signed an application because we were in a department store, and they said, go ahead and apply for our credit card, and if you do, we'll give you 20% off on the purchases you're making today. So we end up with this credit card that probably goes into a desk drawer or a dresser drawer, and you never think about it until you get tired of seeing these notices that say, well, here's your zero balance for the month. And, you know, cleaning up your credit by canceling the card out, I can't imagine a credit bureau taking that as a stroke against you.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, let's go to someone here on a cell phone. This is line number three. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I have a credit card question also, but going back to the last question, I'm just curious. I thought that that taking out a new credit card does, or it's canceling one that you have, does affect your credit score because the FICO people or whoever does these calculations take into account how much credit you have been allotted across all the credit cards. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong, but I think we're perhaps looking at different measures for different purposes. If you have a credit line overall, so let's say three credit cards, each with $5,000 limits, you've got a $15,000 credit line and revolving consumer credit. If all of a sudden that were to drop dramatically because you canceled all three cards, then obviously you would hit in a lower scale level of a person for a credit bureau score. Would it be a mark against you? Only in a sense of saying that you wouldn't be playing with the realm of people who have a $15,000 unsecured consumer line of credit available to them. What I was assuming we were talking about, and maybe I shouldn't have done this, but what I was assuming we were talking about are the kind of promotional credit cards that sometimes people end up with. Because again, they've walked into a store, and if you sign up for our Sears credit card today, we'll give you 20% off on purchases. Those credit cards issued under those circumstances very seldom have significant credit limits on them, and
okay. And
very seldom have significant impacts into the entire scoring system of a credit bureau that basically looks at a person and says, do they have a history? Is the history good? At what level is the history good? So,
I think maybe we were talking about slightly different things. My question about credit cards is this. If you have just gotten a 0% interest rate on purchases as well as transfers on a new credit card for 1 year, as you put charges onto that card, let's say you put in $1,000 a month on that card, up to a $10,000 limit. How does the credit card company figure the minimum amount you have to pay on that credit card per $1,000?
Basically, any way they want to.
Oh, okay.
and let me give you a little hint as to their bias.
Okay.
They will set the number in terms of dollars per minimum payment as low as possible. Because if you look very closely in the fine print, the balance that you carry over that 0% interest for a year, they're hoping a majority of it is still outstanding a year later. And this is where you need to read the terms of the contract very, very carefully. They may even allow themselves to go back and charge you interest on the balances over the 12 months just passed.
That's assuming you don't pay it off in 12 months.
And that's why they set the minimum payment amount at a very low number to hope that in the 13th month you've still got a good outstanding balance.
Okay, so they're gambling that you're not going to do it.
No, they're not gambling that you're going to do it. They are trying to modify and influence your behavior.
But what I mean is there is a certain amount of risk they are taking in the sense that if you do pay it off in your 11th month, let's say, they have not gotten anything out of it.
If you do indeed go into the 11th month and pay off all of the balance again, you'd have to check the terms of the agreement very carefully. But in most I've seen, then you would not be subject to any interest charges for the balances you carried in that 11-month period. Don't forget, however, the person who does that is the exception and not the rule. And,
oh, yeah.
And the other thing is the credit card company and the issuing bank do share in every component of income from interchange fees. So every time the card is used, there is basically a revenue stream created for Visa or MasterCard or whoever and the issuing bank. It's small relative to the interest charges, but it is a revenue stream that they otherwise wouldn't have had.
Okay, so they're benefiting, but the fact is that I'm not being penalized.
Well, every time you use a credit card, you could say you're being penalized, just like every time you're paying for something in cash. The interchange fee basically boils down to this. If I hand a clerk a $100 bill for a $100 purchase, they have the money immediately. If I hand them a credit card, they have the money electronically, immediately. They do not have $100. They basically have about $95. There's a 5%, it's a rough number, very rough number, but an approximate 5% interchange fee. So if you looked at this across the economy and said, well, how does that affect the cost, the $100 that I had to pay for these goods and services, don't you think merchants build that into their pricing structure?
Sure, but but I'm only indirectly being penalized for that, very indirectly.
I wouldn't say that you are being penalized or any single individual is being penalized. I would say that all of us consumers in the structure of the system, the way we have it, are paying a convenience fee in the price of the goods and services we purchase.
Okay.
So we're paying for service.
Right. Okay. But if I were to spend $1,000 a month on this credit card and use or put, let's say, my utilities on this credit card, save that money, deposit it somewhere, get 5% interest on it or whatever, at the end of 11 months, I pay off the credit card because I've been saving this money, but I've also earned interest on it, and so consequently, I have then gained something, maybe up to $1,000 worth of interest. Now, that the credit card is assuming I don't have the discipline to do that, and that most people won't do that. But that, as far as I can see, with the exception of these minimal fees that you would pay once a month, you could come out ahead.
You could, but let me do a little quick math for you. I'm going to say $1,000 a month over 12, so I'm going to say I'm just going to use an average balance of $6,000.
Yeah.
The structure that you just outlined is really cool. I love it because it fits what we call an arbitrage strategy. Here's what it means. You're going to take your $1,000 a month and let's pretend earn 5% on it.
Right.
Okay. Let me tell you that on an average balance of $6,000 for a full year, that's a $300 interest earnings. Okay?
Wait a second.
Okay. Bear with me. And if you're fruitful, if you're really true to form and you're an organized person and things don't get in your way and you don't forget to take care of it in the 11th month, then, yeah, you've earned a $300 interest arbitrage in doing so. Again, assuming that there literally is no interest charge on the credit card when you pay off the whole balance. So, again, here comes the fine print. Get out your reading glasses like I do when I read it.
Okay.
And then let me just close the loop here. Let's say something happens and you get busy in the 11th month and forget to pay it off, and the credit card happens to be one of those cards that allows itself to charge you interest on the balance carried over the past 12 months that is not paid off. I'm going to make that same $6,000 average balance. I'm going to go on the same 12-month basis. I'm going to use a nice 18% rate of interest, and I'm going to say you've just incurred a $1,300 interest expense. You've made $300 interest income. Let me tell you that the interest expense of $1,300 is not tax deductible. Let me tell you that the interest that you earn on your arbitrage is taxable income. So after you pay the taxes on the $300 interest earned and net that out against the non-tax deductible consumer interest expense of $1,300, ask yourself, was the arbitrage worth it?
Oh, you're absolutely right. It requires careful discipline, setting this up on automatic banking, online things, so the things go out regularly. You don't miss a payment. You pay it off in the 11th month. Absolutely assumes all those things, and you know, that's what the credit card company is banking on, that you won't be able to do that.
And pray to God that you're not somewhere else in the 11th month attending to an ill family member that prohibits you from making this luscious $300 before tax arbitrage. I always like to look at risk and return. To me, your strategy is beautiful. It fulfills on an arbitrage opportunity. I just don't see the reward potential given the risk.
Okay.
But that's my personal bias.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more. In this part of Focus 580, Kevin Waspy is here. He's a lecturer of finance at the College of Business at the U of I, sitting in this month for David Sinnoh. It's our regular monthly show on personal finance. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, someone in Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes, wonderful discussion here, Kevin. And
well, thank you.
Interesting that you've, in this last conversation, you mentioned being an organized person, and she mentioned the discipline of paying bills on time and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was wondering if you could speak to the kind of tools the ordinary person could use to be disciplined and organized. And I'm thinking of, I know myself, I use a calendar. As a reminder, I have a calendar on my computer, but you could use just the standard calendar and write down dates, due dates, and that type of thing as a reminders. Accounting system, you know, the Quicken type of simple, straightforward accounting or Microsoft Money. To be honest with you, I wonder how the ordinary person can handle their financial aspects of their life today without some help. And I think this is one of the big challenges for folks. And I'll get off the air and let you speak to that. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you. David Inge was just laughing because I reached into my briefcase and I pulled out what I refer to as my PAA. That's my personal analog advisor. I'm not an electronic age person, so PDAs don't work it for me. And when I'm forced to, then I have to use a computer to do things, then I do. But bottom line is, I'm not trying to make light of the question because it's an excellent question. I've never found a good replacement for a basic calendar. The calendar that I have happens to be an iBook. So because my life kind of revolves around the campus, this little 9-inch by 4-inch spiral bound book has every day of the year in it laid out in two different formats. It has university deadline type of things that I have to be cognizant of, and allows me to write in there everything that I need to refer to at whatever point in time I become aware of it or any change I need to make to it. If you're an electronic age person, you can use your calendar and Outlook. You can use all kinds of, software contact planning programs, whether it's something like ACT or half of the programs that I've used in past lives, so on and so forth. They're all wonderful, but it all boils down to this. Number one, if you're disciplined and use it, it's perfect. That's it. Number two, as long as it's something that you can get to when you need it, and that's why I favor a PAA. So my personal analog assistant that is my iBook, I don't care if I'm here or in Ketchikan, it's with me, and my PC isn't.
It is possible now for if people are really concerned about or don't want to think about paying their bills and to do an electronic funds transfer and just to sign up and say to the company, say to Ameren or the water company or your mortgage company or whatever, is say, okay, here's the number of my bank account. I authorize you to go there and get the money. Now, I suppose also some people would say, I don't like that idea. I don't want them to going into my bank account. I want to have to sit down and write the check and put the stamp on it and send it to them.
Yeah, I have no problem with it from a security point of view or feeling like somebody's going to know something about me that they shouldn't. That's not the issue. Let me just go back to a very, very basic. When it comes to money and management, every time you want to do something that minimizes the management, you've just made a statement about what you feel your money is worth. Think of it this way. If you want to set up good discipline habits about managing your money rather than your money managing you, it should take you a little time. It should take you a little effort, and it should bring you on a regular basis consciously in touch with your spending and saving and investing habits. If it doesn't, then you're becoming too numb to it. So this goes right back to the basics when a person says, Kevin, how do I really become rich investing? And the first thing you have to do is become rich in your saving habits. It's something silly. It's a little bit like you like direct deposit or your employer does not give you a choice of direct deposit of your paycheck. They just do it that way. They don't even hand you a check. Fine. Go ahead and have the direct deposit made, but do not have it made to your checking account. Have it made to your savings account. You see, because I look at that receipt of income from a paycheck and say, that's my money until I choose to give it to somebody else. I have to choose once a month to write a check to Ameren. I have to choose once a month to write a check to AT&T, so on and so forth. But you see, that's my choice. I sit down. When the envelope comes and the Ameren bill is in it, I open it up, I look at it and see if it's something that's out of the ordinary and I need to check and make sure that there's not a bad meter reading. I then immediately write the due date on the outside of the envelope. It goes in my bill drawer that I look at every day. As it comes to the top of the stack and it's 5, 6, 7 days away from being paid, it comes out of the drawer, the check is written, the stamp is put on it, it's gone. It makes me consciously think about who I'm giving my money to and how much. If I have no tangent to it, then my spending habits get out of whack with what I'd like my savings and investment habits to be. The habit that I do personally enjoy is every month I have money taken out of my savings account and goes into a mutual fund. I've done that for years. So you see, I'm automatically setting my savings and investing side of the ledger, and I am consciously, manually, continually reminding myself monthly about the spending side of the ledger.
Okay. We got one more caller here. Someone in Paxton, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have some savings bonds that I acquired back in the late 80s, and I would like to know if I should cash those in and open up a Roth IRA?
It really depends. And one of the things that you could probably find very helpful would be the local bank. The local bank, well, you could go online and you could pull up the Treasury's website. You could see what the conditions of those bonds are. In other words, what rate of interest they're earning, what their value is, so on and so forth. With the help of somebody at the bank, which is probably where you're going to go anyway to redeem them, they could do that and perhaps a little bit more, and that is to talk with you about what it is you're earning there as a tax advantage versus what you might earn with a Roth.
Okay.
So again, without knowing the particulars about the savings bonds, I would say that's a beginning point. Get the particulars on them. See if there are any tax. Some of the savings bonds that were issued in the past do have some nice tax advantages. To set up a Roth is always a good idea. I would say that you could set up a Roth tomorrow with any amount of minimum deposit that a bank, a mutual fund company, wherever you choose to set up a Roth IRA would do it. Go ahead and start it, because one of the more important things about a Roth IRA is starting the clock.
Okay. Thank
starting
you.
The clock. So go ahead and take a minimum sum of money from some other place, some other source of savings, and set up a Roth.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we'll try to do one more caller here. We have somebody, I think, on a cell phone. This is line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
This has been a very interesting show. I want to thank you a lot. I would like to respectfully disagree and give a little bit of a different perspective on some of the stuff you were talking about, automatic payments. I think the whole idea of being conscious and, you know, paying attention to your spending every month, it is an excellent thing for people to strive for. But I think there are a lot of people who don't want to deal with their money. And maybe that's not very evolved of them, but it's still the fact. And if they don't, they can get into trouble. I mean, I got into trouble several years ago, not because I didn't have the money to pay my bills, but because I hadn't developed these organizational skills. And what really helped me bridge that gap was using online banking, setting up an automatic payment to all my credit cards every month. And then for about 5 years, I just forgot about my money and was so happy not to think about it. And I find now I'm working myself into a place where I can be more conscious about it. But I just want to throw out there that this idea that you have to be very controlled and very conscious, and that it's not good to use the online banking tools, but that may hinder people from being able to get organized enough to kind of break through to a new place in how they can manage their money.
No, I understand and I agree with you completely. What I didn't mean to say is that everyone must, and then, you know, Kevin says, you know, like the old game we played when we were kids, Simon says. Maybe I said it too strongly. What I really meant to say was, number one, this is my personal bias. Number two, these are goals. So when a person asks me, how do I control my money? I place a lot of focus on the word control.
Right.
So I establish what I would say are, these are the goals you should have. This is something to aim for. And in no way did I mean to play the game seven, Kevin says.
Right. Well, you know, I think that's an excellent message to get out there. But I did just want to put it out there, too, that use the tools you need to keep yourself out of trouble if that's what potentially is happening.
No question of it. If a person finds that, you know, they use these literally as tools, then I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm.
Striving to have more control over your own destiny is the goal that I just hang out there in the future. And I would probably then amend what I said earlier to put it this way and say, use the tools that are available to you to best achieve that end.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And again, we'll try real quick. Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask, I'm a retired person, and when I tried to put money in an IRA, they won't let me at tax time because I don't have earned income.
That's correct.
And why do they do that?
When individual retirement accounts were originally set up under the tax code way back in the 70s, that was the way the law was written. In essence, Congress gave the working person only that tax break, if you want to call it that way. Working meant actively engaged for income, so in the definition of a 1040, earned income as opposed to dividends, rents, royalties, so on and so forth.
And they're not going to change that anytime soon, because it's nice to be able to take advantage of, you know, putting $1,000 or something like that into your into an IRA at tax time to get that little bit of nudge on your taxes.
I wouldn't anticipate any change that would broaden the use of those types of abilities to reduce income taxes. As a matter of fact, I'd make a half-baked prediction and say that as we move forward in the coming 2 to 3 years, you are going to see more pressures to remove some of the tax favors that have been built into the code over the past 10 years.
Somehow I think you're probably right.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. I want to thank everybody who called in today, and also thank our guest, Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, for stopping by. That's a program we do every month here on a Friday to give people a chance to ask questions about money management. Now, I don't know who's going to be here next month. Somebody is going to be here.
It may be me again.
It might be you.
And I apologize in advance for boring you.
Oh, stop it. Kevin Waspy, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.